favorite for the position. But progressive groups and unions say she's too close to major oil and agricultural companies. They have pushed for Joe Biden to appoint House Representative Marcia Fudge, who has advocated for expanding SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Chloe Waterman claimed, "Marcia Fudge recognizes that we need food access coupled with food equality." She added, "Reversing the rise in hunger could be done by expanding SNAP payouts and eligibility. That could bring relief to the Baltimore Hunger Project, which has seen demand triple to more than 2,000 families since the coronavirus pandemic struck." Ayo Akinremi, an immigrant from Nigeria who started picking up groceries for his wife and children after losing his job and now volunteers with the group, says, "It breaks my heart," he added. "It was a culture shock for me to come to the United States to find so much food insecurity."
Aperture. Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish, and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
That is gold.
Kinga.
Kingo.
Gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
El oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
So gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the Kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name. And he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is bezant, the best currency. The bezant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The bezant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500. Well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a thousand year coin, if you like.
The bezant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the bezant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the bezant survived for 1,000 years. The bezant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you were a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square, so they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. the time, the population which had been devastated by the plague was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight.
The Biden-Harris administration is building an experienced criminal team by nominating for some top policy posts as well, including Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, National Security Advisor, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, among others. This will surely help extend America's interventionist policies in Muslim heartlands through diplomatic channels. This is not about looking to enter a new era of U.S. foreign policy, but rather trying to step back into the pre-Trump world. This is while America's endless war is pretty much universally recognized as the worst foreign policy blunder in its 21st century history. Yet now, Biden wants to reward them for it. He says, no retreat from Clinton, Bush, and Obama years here. And all this and more are bad news not only for the war-stricken people of the West Asia region, but Palestine and elsewhere. The Biden administration will definitely move to suppress Palestinian rights as well, even the BDS campaign, a peaceful protest movement protected by the UN Charter. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading, The Empire of Chaos is Back Under Biden. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Joe Biden has announced infamous nominees for his national security and foreign policy team. He says America is back and ready to lead the world. The former vice president's comments are an apparent reflection of what the world community should expect under his foreign policy mandate, because his team reflects the fact that America is once again ready to mess with the world for all the wrong reasons. Under the circumstances, expect Biden to not retreat from America's endless wars. It will also sit once again at the head of the United Nations Security Council table, releasing sanctions resolutions to confront sovereign nations with much-needed help from Western allies, ready to stand up for the bogus war on terror et al. To this end, he has picked Antony Blinken, a former Obama administration official and longtime Biden aide, who has a history of pushing for U.S. wars and military interventions in places like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. The idea is to rebuild trust in the war state and bogus alliances. He has also picked Avril Haines to be his director of national intelligence, who served as both the deputy director of the CIA and the deputy national security advisor under Obama. Haines has a racist history of running cover for CIA torture programs and served under former CIA chief John Brennan when the Obama administration criminally increased drone strikes in places like Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, and North Africa. He also helped crush anti-racism protests at home. No wonder human rights groups and peace activists have sounded the alarm over Biden's picks. These are the same criminals that launched endless wars against dozens of Muslim states in the West Asia region and played key roles in drone strike policy during Barack Obama's presidency. These are also the same goons that covered up the torture perpetrated by members of George W. Bush administration. Biden says preparations for more of the same are expected to follow. The Biden-Harris administration is building an experienced criminal team by nominating for some top policy posts as well, including Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, National Security Advisor, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, among others. This will surely help extend America's interventionist policies in Muslim heartlands through diplomatic channels. This is not about looking to enter a new era of U.S. foreign policy, but rather trying to step back into pre-Trump world. This is while America's endless war is pretty much universally recognized as the worst foreign policy blunder in its 21st century history. Yet now Biden wants to reward them for it. He says no retreat from the Clinton, Bush, and Obama years here. All this and more are bad news not only for the war-stricken people of the West Asia region, but Palestine and elsewhere. The Biden administration will definitely move to suppress Palestinian rights as well, even the BDS campaign, a peaceful protest movement protected by the UN Charter. He won't change course from Trump's State Department policies in his respect. Quite the opposite. The ex-Obama administration staffers will target and suppress support of Palestinian human rights everywhere, even at the UN. It is going to be pretty much business as usual for other nations as well, meaning huge war spending, a heavy U.S. footprint in the world, and this outdated notion that the U.S. should be at the head of the table when it comes to human rights and international human law. The ex-Obama administration staffers will create legal justification for Biden's drone wars and support for further blockades on Yemen, Syria, and Gaza. At the same time, leading human rights groups and the UN Human Rights Watch speak out fervently against these criminal policies, but to no avail. There is a saying in Washington that personnel is policy. As things stand, the ex-Obama administration staffers or Biden's group of national security pigs are all war criminals and should be held to account at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The world will not sleep easier until they are brought to justice. They are not picked to end America's endless wars. And certainly, this is unfortunate news for many war-stricken countries in the West Asia region. They are in no way picked to undo Trump's damage or Obama's damage. And certainly, they cannot build a more compassionate and common-sense foreign policy agenda for the United States of America. Put simply, they are excellent choices to help extend the destructive reach of the empire of chaos on this planet of ours. What else do you expect from a former vice president that backed the illegal wars on Iraq and Syria and drone bombing campaigns in countries like Pakistan and Yemen? This is also the same politician that, in the 1990s, co-sponsored a bill with John McCain to send troops into Yugoslavia and later advocated a troop surge in Afghanistan and aerial warfare in Syria and Yemen. He's now telling us that the U.S. must take the same devastating lead in the policing the world. The strategy of global military domination with help from his scandalous circles.
Around the world with reporters.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested Eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led U.S. Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Humana Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world,
and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Aklına herhangi bir şey gelen bakıyorsunuz.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Reshan Saglam, Istanbul.
A number of ambassadors and military attachés of different countries in Taiwan have signed a memorial book to commemorate the high status of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top Iranian scientist who was assassinated on November 27th. The diplomats have voiced their hatred and condemnation against this act of terror.
The
Right after the assassination, Russia strongly condemned the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and believes that the main goal of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear program. The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, where the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is too low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting and help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering. Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, 2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to be hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With the coronavirus pandemic surging and initial vaccine supplies limited, the United States faces a hard choice. Should the country's immunization program focus in the early months on the elderly and people with serious medical conditions who are dying of the coronavirus at the highest rates, or on essential workers, an expansive category encompassing Americans who have borne the greatest risk of coronavirus infection? The article you're about to hear has been written by journalists Abby Goodenough and Jan Hoffman, writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled, the elderly versus essential workers. Who should get the coronavirus vaccine first? Stay with us for more of Abby Goodenough and Jan Hoffman's article.